History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In today's episode and episodes in the past, I've looked at the topic of family history, and that's usually involved war heroes, Holocaust survivors, or in general people who overcame incredible odds. But sometimes family history can be a lot darker. That's the case in today's episode because this family history directly involves Joseph Stalin. Today's guest is Alex Halberstadt. He's the author of the book Young Heroes of the Soviet Union, and his grandfather was the last living bodyguard of Joseph Stalin. He protected Stalin for several years, survived numerous purges, even though he thought that he could die any day, and he had to deal with the conflict of being a patriotic Soviet, but directly saw the purges that Stalin did and the tortures and executions ordered by him and his generals and all sorts of horrific things. Alex is a Russian-American author, and he went to Ukraine to talk with his grandfather about those experiences, but also talked with other family members about the trauma they experienced in the Soviet Union. He went to Lithuania, his Jewish mother's home, to look at the legacy of the Holocaust and the anti-Semitism there. But he also recounts experiences of his parents, who were against the Soviet system. In the 70s, his mother consoled dissidents at a psychiatric hospital, and his father made a living dealing in black market American records, selling John Coltrane LPs for a fortune. So we talk about some of the highest levels of power in the Soviet Union in this episode, but we also dig into some really big questions, which is if a nation itself can experience trauma, and whether or not our lives are lived in response to events that we can't identify with and we don't remember, and they began decades before our birth. How do we deal with trauma? Is a citizen somehow responsible for things that a nation did? And how do we overcome that? So a lot to unpack here, and I hope you enjoy this discussion with Alex Halberstadt. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Scott. Very happy to be here.
Well, you have a fascinating family history. There is a lot to unpack here. And I suppose we can begin with your understanding of what your family history was when you were growing up. So what did you understand of your family history before you took it upon yourself to dig in and actually visit your family members abroad?
Scott, I grew up in the country that was known then as the Soviet Union. And of course, part of the, I grew up in Moscow. My maternal grandparents lived in Lithuania in a city called Vilnius. And my paternal grandfather lived in Ukraine, which were all part of the Soviet Union at the time. As you probably know, the Soviet Union was a kind of idea state, right? It was a country that wasn't based on the idea of ethnic character or ethnic singularity, but was based on the idea that it was a multinational, multi-ethnic nation, much like the United States. And, you know, there was always an emphasis on saying that all people were equal. Of course, even as a kid, I knew that that wasn't really true. My mother and her family were Jewish. And, you know, in the Soviet Union, the Jews definitely were not equal. So I was always aware of that. But I think having left when I was 9, my understanding about my own family's history was pretty, I would say, pretty foggy, you know, pretty vague. I think my parents were, and my grandparents knew better than to tell me too much about it. It was a country where speaking openly about history was not a good idea and could be punished by any number of things. The Soviet past of the Stalin era, especially things like collectivization and the Great Terror and the Gulag, were not topics that were spoken about very openly or written about very openly, and certainly not among children, certainly not in schools. I did a couple of years of elementary school in the Soviet Union in Moscow, and you know, the image of the country that we were presented with was a very whitewashed one, a very patriotic one. And, you know, my book takes its title from a book we had as first graders, which was a textbook for first graders across all the 11 time zones of the Soviet Union, which was called Young Heroes of the Soviet Union, which was essentially a book about, you know, children, usually teenagers who had committed acts of patriotism for their country for which they, you know, usually for which the, because of which they were put to death or had died. So it was a pretty gruesome text for a bunch of 7-year-olds. But our understanding of the Soviet Union was pretty monolithic and I would say pretty artificial. You know, there was a lot of, I would say, propaganda and inoculation that was happening at the time. And, you know, I think like a lot of Soviet kids, I was pretty patriotic. I really believed in a lot of it. And I think I was too young to really have the conversations with my parents and my friends that would have given me a more nuanced vision, a nuanced notion of the country where we lived. So to answer, this is a long way of saying my understanding of my own family history was pretty incomplete.
Right. And when you started to learn about this, specifically your grandfather, who was a bodyguard of Joseph Stalin, when did you learn about that? Did the rest of your family know about it, speak about it? And then I suppose you could mention meeting him too and that whole story.
Of course, yeah. My grandfather, who was named Vasily, he grew up in Ukraine. He was an outstanding cadet in military school. And beginning in the early 1930s, he attended a school for basically secret policemen in Moscow. And to be essentially recruited and sent to that school was a great honor. He was the son of a farmer. So, you know, he really got there through his own excellence as a soldier and an officer. And beginning in 1932, when he graduated, he was a worker for the organization that would come to be known as the KGB, essentially the secret police, which at the time was called the NKVD and would later be known by other acronyms. And in 1941, he was made a bodyguard of Stalin, which is a job that he kept until the end of Stalin's life in 1953. As I was growing up, you know, I had heard about this in a very kind of, I think, vague way. Beginning when we had left the country when I was 9 years old, my maternal grandparents, I think, said it to me first. He was a man who had done unmentionable things. Of course, what those unmentionable things were, I wouldn't learn until quite a bit later. He and my father had not spoken since I was 3 months old. My father really hated my grandfather. Vasily was not what you would call today a good parent. He was fairly brutal and physically abusive. I think in his own way, he probably tried, but having the life that he did, I think made his emotional life a pretty rudimentary one, you know, as I would learn later. I met him in 2004 for the first time. And it happened because my father, who lives in Moscow, his son, we would have these kind of monthly telephone conversations. And one day my father said, you know, a cousin had called me and told me that my dad is still alive. And at that point, it was 2004. I think I had assumed that my grandfather had been dead for decades. He already was at that time 93 years old. And so this was a real revelation to me. I had no idea that my grandfather was alive. It came as a real shock. And by that time, I had figured out a little bit more about what he had done in his life. I just by the dint of being interested in history and having read a lot about history, and having asked my father and my mother some questions about who he had been. So suddenly I was aware that he was alive and that he was actually still quite lucid, according to this distant relative. So I decided to go to Ukraine and meet him, mostly because I was becoming convinced that there was something that this man knew that would help me make sense of my own life and help me make sense of my own family. By that time, I had been living in New York. I was a writer. I had published a book. So the idea that this part of my family was out there, that this man who had done these incredible things was still alive and could potentially talk to me about it was really fascinating. So I called him on the phone and he picked up the phone and said, I said, this is your grandson. I'd like to come and meet you. And he said, I don't have a grandson. I think he had forgotten maybe. And then his wife, Sonia, came on the phone and said, we have a photo of you. If you come, he'll remember. And in fact, he did. And so that's really how the story of this book begins. I went to Ukraine to a city called Vinnytsia, where he had lived in the same apartment where my father had grown up all those years ago. And we spent several weeks together putting together the story of his life, which was very dramatic and at times really quite terrifying.
Well, yeah, I'm very curious about this. So what was his story when he becomes Stalin's bodyguard and then afterwards? And how does he personally express it? Is there remorse, or does he still feel that he was part of a patriotic cause by what he did? What was that all?
That's a really good question. It turned out that he had a really complicated story, and it was complicated because the government, the system under Stalin was incredibly complicated. Without sort of going down a huge rabbit hole, the bodyguards of Stalin reported to a man named General Vlasic, who was basically almost Stalin's chief of staff. Though chief of staff is not quite it, he helped Stalin's children do their homework. He was literally somebody who lived in Stalin's home and was a member of his household. He was also, by all accounts, a man who was not deeply bright or educated, but he was the man to whom all the bodyguards reported. And I think at the height, there probably was around 500 of them. So putatively, the bodyguards were part of the KGB, but Stalin didn't trust the KGB. He didn't trust almost anyone. So they were kind of an autonomous force. And one of the strange things that I learned as I was talking to my grandfather is that he seemed to be very closely associated with a man named Lavrenty Beria, who was the head of the secret police and also the head of the Gulag, the head of the prison camp system of the Soviet Union. And I couldn't quite figure out how that worked. And it took me quite a bit of research and consultation with people like, several scholars of Stalin, Simon Sebag Montefiore in the UK, and Stephen Kotkin, who is writing a 3-volume biography of Stalin as a professor at Princeton. Talking to them helped me figure out that there was a kind of tug of war between Beria and General Vlasic. They essentially hated each other, and Beria was constantly trying to infiltrate the inner circle of Stalin's bodyguards. And so he made a habit of befriending them and often sort of trying to draw them into his own circle as a way of essentially getting some eyes and ears in Stalin's Stalin's retinue. I mean, as it happened in 1953, when Stalin died, many people think that he had been in fact poisoned on Joseph Lavrenty Beria's orders, and in fact that Beria had killed him. Now, I don't know if that's true. There is definitely a lot of debate about that, but we do know that Beria became the head of the Soviet Union along with Nikita Khrushchev, along with I think it was Malenkov, who and for some months was the most powerful man in the country. He was eventually imprisoned and shot, and was replaced by Nikita Khrushchev, who became the premier of the Soviet Union for the next 10 years or so. But, my grandfather basically had become a kind of double agent. He told me a story about being in Beria's limousine. Beria drove around in a Packard, which was given to the Soviet Union by their wartime ally, the United States. It was a big black Packard limousine, and he remembers being in the car while Beria abducted a young woman from the sidewalk, which Beria was known to do. He was kind of a womanizer and famous for abducting and raping women and then essentially killing them. And my grandfather told me near the end of our time together about being part of one of these outings. And of course, he seemed very broken up about it. I think the woman was about 17 or 18, and she essentially was kidnapped and raped by Beria. And my grandfather also told me about being sent by Beria to Crimea to essentially participate in the ethnic cleansing, which I think we can call a genocide of the ethnic Tartars, it's an ethnic Mongolian group in Russia. Who were forcibly relocated from their old home in Crimea to Siberia, a relocation during which tens of thousands of them died. So I had trouble at first, Scott, figuring out how he could have been working for two men at once, two men who seemed to have almost in some ways mutually exclusive jobs. And it took a lot of research to figure out that it wasn't so uncommon that there was all of this overlap that between these two services. And my grandfather's, you know, stories from that time were, of course, absolutely chilling, because he had talked about not only participating in genocide and abductions, but also, you know, as a member of the KGB during the Great Terror, of participating in, you know, interrogations, which often ended in the person being killed on trumped up charges. So it made the experience of talking to him a deeply ambivalent one. You know, how does it feel to have your grandfather be essentially a war criminal? I think that colored a lot of my interactions with Vasily when I first met him. And I'm sure that what he told me was a fraction of everything he had seen and done. And to get around to the part of your question about how he presented it, it was complicated, because at first he wasn't very keen to talk about it. He understood that he had been in some ways on the wrong side of history. But at the same time, it was also a position of great power, right? Of proximity to great power. He had gone with Stalin to the summits at Yalta and to Tehran and in Potsdam, right. Which all happened in sequence. He recalls meeting befriending at one point one of the Secret Service men that were traveling with the FDR, and becoming afraid when he realized that it might be seen as unpatriotic to consort with American Secret Service men. So he, in a sense, it was a very exciting job and a very privileged job. But of course, from the vantage point of today, I think he understood that a lot of it was amounted essentially to torture and genocide. So I think that there was kind of him trying to reconcile these different attitudes, you know, what at the time must have felt like, a position of great power, mixed with the current understanding of it as being in a position of great shame. And I think he was trying to weigh those emotions when he was talking to me. And I think it was only after his wife, Sonia, insisted that he come clean that he started to become more honest with me. Because at first he kind of avoided that period altogether, as though the 30s and 40s just didn't happen. And finally she kind of slammed her hand on the table and says, just tell him the truth. And that's when the story started coming.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. I want to dig into his work and stories from his time with Beria and Stalin. But there's one thing that jumps out to me when you mentioned that he served Stalin from the early 1940s up till his death. And what I thought was, Stalin was known for his purges. It's typically high-level generals and politicians so that he wouldn't have competing factions and he could hold on to his power. But I think, how does somebody manage to survive purges? Did Stalin simply not do that to maybe lower-level functionaries and it was more higher up? Or did your grandfather somehow manage to strike an effective balance so that he wouldn't be targeted by the two men he served who were rivals? I mean, it sounds very dangerous, yet he made it through.
Well, it's weird that you say that, because as far as I know, when I met my grandfather in 2004, he was Stalin's last living bodyguard. He was 93, and it was a job, obviously, that people didn't really live very long in. A lot of them were murdered, a lot of them officially murdered, meaning purged. Some were sent to the gulag, some were shot. Quite a few committed suicide, because I think the pressures of those jobs were unimaginable. The pressures on your sort of constitution, but also the pressures on your conscience. You know, you were constantly doing things that were morally unthinkable. Most of the people purged by Stalin were innocent. And I think it was assumed that the charges leveled against them were not supposed to be real charges, that nobody believed them to be. At least most people, I think, understood that. You know, people in the late 30s in Russia were killed by quota. Moscow called the local KGB office and said, we need this many people arrested today or this week. And that's how it was done. But to go back to your question, I think my grandfather was a person who could seem a little naive at times, which was very much not the way he really was. He was a quiet person. He was very handsome. And I think he was very good at taking orders without questioning them. He was obedient. He was efficient. But he was also quite smart, as I learned. And I think often he tried to use that to his own advantage. I'll give you an example. When I came back from meeting him, I started to do a lot of research about this period. And I found a book of, you know, essentially a book of every member of the Soviet secret police who had been in any way remarkable. So anyone who had received high orders or medals, anyone who had gone to the big Communist Party conventions, anyone who had been in a position of leadership. And sure enough, I did not find my grandfather's name anywhere on those lists. And so I asked him about it afterwards in a phone call. And he said, well, you didn't want to stick out. You didn't want any notoriety. You didn't want any achievement because essentially it would make you a target. So in the 1930s, the secret police apparatus of the Soviet Union was purged three times, meaning all the leadership was essentially shot, imprisoned, and removed. I think the secret police was purged more than any other sector of Soviet society simply because Stalin didn't trust them. And also they had done horrible things that killing these people would essentially erase, right, into a certain way of thinking. And so my grandfather, I think, resisted any kind of promotion, resisted any kind of notoriety during those years, which essentially, I think, allowed him to survive. And he did it consciously, not through the way things turn out, but deliberately. He said one had to keep his own counsel then, you know, and you didn't want to stick out. And he didn't, you know, he was somebody who could play dumb, essentially. And I think that's what he chose to do all through the late 30s, because that was a time when so many of his coworkers, so many of his teachers had disappeared. I mean, he said he would come to work and the person would be gone and all mention of them would be gone and they would be airbrushed from photos and so their names would be removed from official records. People just vanished. And I think he realized that this was probably that remaining in a low-level position and not making a lot of noise was probably the best way to live through that period, which is kind of remarkable because it didn't start out that way. My grandfather had been secretary of the Komsomol, which is the Young Communist League. Every university and school has it. And it was almost being like class president. So he had been the secretary of the Secret Police Academy in Moscow, where he had attended university. And because of that position, he was invited to a dinner in the Kremlin in 1932, celebrating the 15th anniversary of the Communist Revolution, which is a dinner where he met Stalin for the first time, years before he actually would work for him in his capacity as a bodyguard. It's also the night, that dinner was the night when Stalin's wife was either committed suicide or was killed, depending on which account you believe in. So he had started out with all of this kind of promise of, you know, a remarkable career, which never materialized because essentially it became too dangerous to have a remarkable career in the Soviet secret police.
Something that I've seen in terms of getting into the detailed lives of politicians and other people is that bodyguards probably have the best insider information of anyone. With presidential biographies in the United States, there are always references from bodyguards because they see the president when their guard is down. Eventually, a bodyguard might seem like wallpaper and you would say unguarded comments. So did he have insight into Beria and Stalin and have personal recollections of what they were like?
Yeah, I asked him that question, of course, because it's a really good question and it's, you know, something people generally want to know about. He told me that he said Stalin spoke to him maybe three or four times. He told me that one of his jobs was Stalin would host banquets at the Kremlin. And usually people drink vodka because vodka was what you drank in the Soviet Union at that time. There was also some wine from Georgia. And one of the things, but people generally toasted the vodka. And one of the things that Stalin liked to do is he liked watching people drink while drinking water himself. You know, vodka doesn't look much different than water. So Stalin liked to see people get drunk because he believed it made them more honest while staying sober himself. And my grandfather stood sort of against the wall at these banquets. And there was inevitably a moment, he said, when somebody would raise a toast to Stalin's health. And because the tables were quite long, they would sometimes get up and try to approach Stalin physically to pronounce the toast. And his job was to essentially intercept this person who was probably already maybe a little bit in the bag and sort of guide them back to their seat. Because, you weren't allowed to approach Stalin physically. So my grandfather remarked that he thought that Stalin always pretended like he didn't notice that this was happening, but he knew that Stalin really enjoyed the show of force. He really liked when this happened. He said that Stalin took real pleasure in, watching him do this. But generally, though, he said that he really admired Stalin as a person. He said that he was modest and comported himself modestly, and he was often concerned about people around him. He said that the first time he spoke to him, he said, "Are you getting your salary?" He wanted to know that people were okay. He really, I think my grandfather in a way really looked up to him. He thought he was, a great leader. Certainly at the time that he was his bodyguard, I think he told me that he thought that he was actually a really admirable person who was, modest and listened and, was not quick to anger. Of course, it's hard to square that with what we know about Stalin from history, right? So it's an interesting perspective. It's interesting to remember that during this time, a lot of people really looked at Stalin almost as a demigod, that this is not like a leader in a Western democracy. This was sort of the absolute leader who had, taken the country through incredible calamities, some of which, of course, were calamities of his own making, collectivization, the Great Terror, years of hunger and famine, of course, World War II. So I think people really did, a lot of Russians and a lot of Soviet citizens really did see Stalin as an almost godlike figure. So I'm not surprised that my grandfather, in a way, maybe shared in that a little bit. With Beria, I think he hated Beria. He told me that he did, because he said Beria was the smartest of them all. But and Beria really was, I think, a person of rare maliciousness. I mean, he was somebody who was in some ways incredibly cunning and very smart, but also somebody who, was the architect of the terror, was in the architect of the gulag, and kind of the person who carried out a lot of what we now know as the purges. And somebody who personally took great pleasure in causing people pain. There's a story from, history books where Beria is brought up from Georgia. I think he was a deputy head of the Georgian Communist Party. And sometime in the late 30s, he's known Stalin from before. They're both Georgians. And he comes to Moscow, and he's now, has this new job as the head of the secret police. So he invites his former boss from Georgia to Moscow. But this whole family, this is the former head of the Georgian Communist Party. This is in Simon Sebag Montefiore's book about Stalin. And he gives this man a tour of Lubyanka, which is the great KGB prison in the center of Moscow. And during this tour, he locks this guy and his wife in one cell and puts their teenage son in the cell opposite so they can see, and has his guards beat their son to death while they're watch. And then he throws a poisonous snake into their cell and leaves. That's the kind of man he was. He was really, I think you can honestly say that he was a sadist, somebody who truly enjoyed inflicting harm and pain on people. And I think, and my grandfather said, I hated him more than anyone. He was the worst of them. And also the smartest. So I think Beria was, I think Beria was, I think he endured being with Beria, but I think he also probably played along because he understood that it was important to his survival to play along and to be Beria's corner, to essentially cultivate Beria's favor. And strangely enough, when I said what happened after Stalin died, my grandfather said, "Well, I was ordered to be a guard in a labor camp, in a prison camp in Siberia." Now, of course, after Stalin dies, all of the guards, all of the bodyguards associated with him are either arrested, shot, or sent to work in the Gulag. In Nadezhda Aluyeva's memoir, this is Stalin's daughter. Svetlana Aluyeva's memoir. Nadezhda was her mother. She writes that when it is announced that Stalin has died, two of the bodyguards kill themselves because they, I think, understand what's coming. I think there's a wide perception that there would be a purge, and in fact, there was. And I said, "Well, so why didn't you end up going working in this labor camp?" And he said, "Well, my grandfather says, I went to Beria and I asked him to amend that order. And I asked him to send me back to my hometown in Ukraine so I could take care of my elderly parents," which is in fact what happened, because that's where my father was 5 at the time, and he packed him and his family aboard a train and they went to Ukraine. They had one day to leave. They had to literally leave in 24 hours. So we know that this happened. And I said, "Well, how did you get a conversation with the most powerful man in the country, which at that point Beria was, and how did you get him to amend his own order?" Right? I mean, but somehow he did. So clearly they were close, and he was, clearly had spent a lot of time in a circle. And that story kind of convinced me that my grandfather wasn't naive or slow, that he was in fact actually quite smart and quite cunning, because he saved his own life. Being a guard in the prison camp in the Soviet Union was not that different from being a prisoner in that prison camp, right? Because you're still living in wooden barracks in the middle of permafrost, right? It's not that, it's not like being, a guard in a prison. It's really like living in the same kind of wasteland, the frozen wasteland, with the rest of the population of the labor camp. So, Scott, I have to be honest. I mean, there are a lot of things about my grandfather's life that I will never know, because, I think he chose to share with me some of the highlights or lowlights or whatever you might want to call them. But it's an interesting glimpse into that period, for sure.
Right. And I want to take this story to the rest of your family that's in Moscow and then elsewhere. One last thing with Stalin, though, I'm really curious about, because when you mentioned your grandfather had an admiration of his controlled character, but then Beria seems like a sadist. There are different types of totalitarian rulers, and some of them really do seem like sadists, like Idi Amin in Uganda, who had goon squads and torture chambers and personally used machetes to hack off limbs of people before they were gutted and killed. But then you have other totalitarians who almost have an innocence about them, and they believe that what they're doing is for a righteous cause, even though they seem on the outside evil or ridiculous, like a Sapar Murat Niyazov in Turkmenistan, who had a statue that revolved to face the sun. And in a weird way, he doesn't seem like he's a cynic. He really does seem to believe what he's doing is helping Turkmenistan. And what do you think Stalin was? Do you think he had sadistic tendencies, or in his mind, was there a way that having triggered famines and gulags and other things were really for the best of Russia and the world?
That's a really deep question. Stalin was not a zealot. He was a profoundly smart man. I mean, he was a man who was personally involved in censoring art, for example. We know that he would redline manuscripts by novelists and playwrights. He would give Eisenstein edits on his films. He was somebody who really was, he had gone to divinity school. He was not an ignoramus. He was somebody who was quite interested in culture and religion. In terms of your question, though, it's interesting. Certainly, he was a frontline Bolshevik. I mean, he was somebody who was involved in Bolshevism before the Soviet Union. He had been exiled a number of times for his activities and his acts of terrorism, as they were called then, against the Tsar. And certainly his relationship with his inner circle, with the other kind of old line Bolsheviks before 1932, when his wife dies, were certainly collegial. I mean, it's really in the early 30s, with the death of his wife, that things start to become very different, start to curdle, and the tenor of paranoia starts to overtake the Soviet government, which is not to say that things before that were in any way rosy. It's just that I think Stalin was a believer in the communist cause, but I think he was also someone whose sort of personal greed for power, whose considerable paranoia really, I think, in some ways warped his ideology. Not to say that, I mean, the ideology itself was violent from the beginning. Even in the times of Lenin and Trotsky, the Soviet Union was, you know, a country that, you know, used violence and used sort of what we now call acts of terrorism to achieve its goals. But I think, of course, Stalin took it to levels that were unprecedented, where, you know, he committed, you know, mass genocide against essentially his own people. You know, unlike Adolf Hitler, who, you know, committed genocide on a mass scale against, you know, persecuted groups, Stalin targeted mostly the citizens of the Soviet Union, which makes it kind of in a way more confounding, right? Mm-hmm. But I think, I think trying to pull apart the strands of where his ideology ended and where his paranoia began is really difficult. I mean, it was certainly a cult of personality. He was certainly a dictator in the purest sense. He was the absolute ruler of the country. He certainly used methods that have been emulated by many other dictators to maintain power, which is, you know, accusing members of his own government of espionage and, you know, insurrection, of having show trials, of executing them. Certainly he understood a lot about how terror worked, about how fear worked, about instilling, you know, this kind of climate of secrecy and terror, first on his own government and then on the entire country, you know. I mean, the instruments of terror are essentially carried out by ordinary citizens. You know, no government can maintain control of its citizenry all the time. And so, you know, eventually this became the thing we call the Great Terror, and the purges was essentially carried out by ordinary citizens of the Soviet Union who, you know, informed on their neighbors, informed sometimes on their family members, on their coworkers, you know. He transformed the country into this kind of paranoid madhouse where people were, you know, arrested in the night on fictional charges because they had been denounced by somebody, where, you know, arrests were happening by quota, not due to probable cause or evidence. I mean, it's really one of the, I think Stalin is really one of the great mysteries of the 20th century. You know, as a psych, I mean, there have been many psychological profiles of him written, some quite good. But I think teasing apart what made him tick in terms of, you know, whether he was an ideologue or whether he was a kind of personal paranoiac or kind of a sadist, I think it's very difficult. I think I don't know if there is an answer to your question that would be satisfactory. I think he was a mix of the two. He wasn't purely in it for, you know, for the sadism. He was clearly somebody who believed in the mission of communism and in the, you know, in the sort of, I think he in some ways really believed in the project, the Soviet project. But at the same time, he also inflicted unimaginable horror on the Soviet Union and on the people of that country that lasted for decades. So I guess I don't have a satisfactory answer for you. I think it's kind of a part of that is just the work of historical deduction, you know. he was a complex person, you know, and probably one of the most diabolical figures in human history. So I don't know how to answer your question better than that.
Well, that is a very complicated question. So thank you for trying to do that, since it isn't really an either or with someone like Stalin. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. I'm very interested in the rest of your family because on the one hand, you have some like your grandfather who are consummate insiders, bodyguards to Stalin, and then also your grandmother who lived in Moscow and would make clothing items for Soviet ministers' wives. But then others who aren't, like your mother who helps deal with psychological trauma of dissidents and your father who's in the black market. So tell me about your family in Moscow and how they sit on this divide and their stories.
Well, I think the thing to keep in mind, Scott, is that by the time I was born, 1970, the Soviet Union was a really different country. I mean, it had become a much more, I would say, a much less extreme place to live. It was certainly still a totalitarian country. It was not a country with free elections. It was not, the government was centralized. The economy was centralized. There was no real freedom of speech or press or assembly in the way that we understand it in the West. At the same time, it was also peacetime. And it was time of what I would say can be called relative prosperity, certainly compared to kind of the famines and shortages of the first half of the 20th century. So in a way, it was kind of growing up in a fairly, in a much less extreme place than my grandparents had lived. My mother had grown up in Lithuania. Her parents were Jewish. My father was Vasily's son. His mother was from Moscow. So he was ethnically Russian, Ukrainian. My mother was ethnically Jewish in the Soviet Union. That made a big difference. Jews were definitely a kind of prosecuted group. And of course, in the Soviet Union, you had to, even though we were kind of a state that didn't have ethnicity or religion, in your domestic passport, which was the ID you carried with you inside the country, there was a column that said ethnicity, and Jewish was an ethnicity, not a religion. So essentially, if your passport said Jewish, you would be barred from any number of things in Soviet life, attending the college you wanted, the university you wanted, getting certain jobs, being considered for promotion, things like that. So my parents met at Moscow State University when they were 1968, when they were both college students. You know, my mother was interested in psychology. She became a psychologist at a big psychiatric hospital in Moscow. My father, who was Vasily's son, and his mother, as you mentioned, was a clothing designer who had the very enviable job of making clothes for the most powerful women in the Soviet Union, which meant a lot because the economy of the Soviet Union at that time was not an economy of cash. It was an economy of favors and influence. Money didn't buy you very much that you needed. The things that everybody really wanted and needed were always deficit things, things that you needed to get from somebody that were not available in stores. So the thing that really mattered in the Soviet Union was called blat in Russian, which means pull, which means, you know, having juice, having the ability to get rare and desirable things by virtue of either having a powerful position or being able to do favors for other people. So my father loved movies. He got a job at the Film Institute in Moscow, but his real work was selling things on the black market. The Soviet Union had a huge and very developed black market, which means that, you know, anything from the West, you know, anything from good cognac to Levi's jeans to records and books were all contraband, meaning that they were not legally imported into the country. So if you wanted those things, you had to get them privately, which means illegally. And my father knew diplomats and other people who could travel abroad who would bring him suitcases full of rock and jazz records, which is what he sold mostly. As a kid, I remember people coming to our apartment from, you know, sometimes across town, and my father would have a John Coltrane record or, you know, a Rolling Stones record. And I remember he would sell them to these men. It was always guys who would come with these leather bags, you know, and he would sell them, you know, a record that you could buy here in a record store for $10, he would sell it to them for a sum that was the equivalent of a, you know, surgeon's 1 month salary. I mean, for these colossal sums of money, because the rarity and the, you know, of these things in the Soviet Union was such that he could get those prices. So yeah, my father was mostly, you know, a black market record dealer. He also sold some other things, old art books, you know, sometimes jeans, you know, things like that. But mostly he was a record guy and he had very good taste in music, you know, but he, you know, I just remember growing up around the house and there was always somebody showing up to buy a Sinatra record or to buy, you know, a John Coltrane record or to, you know, whatever it was. And of course, sometimes people were coming to sell those things to my father. So it was very much a familiar element of that time. So my parents were, yeah, they were children of the 70s, you know, so the problems of Soviet life had become quite different by that time. But I think, you know, they were in some ways unhappily married. I think their problems were in some ways also the problems of history. My father had stopped speaking to his own father when my parents married. My father hated Vasily, partly because Vasily was, I think, not a very good parent, but I think largely hated him because of what Vasily had done in his life for work. My father hated the Soviet state. He was very much somebody who loved the West. And I think the fact that his father had been a bodyguard of Stalin, also by that time, Stalin had been essentially renounced as a historical figure by Khrushchev. And the fact that his father was a member of the KGB was deeply shameful to my father. And I think my father also understood that his own father had been involved in genocide, had been involved in torture, and he hated him for it. He was deeply ashamed and troubled by this. So I think that was a legacy that my father was trying to live down. And I think his profound interest in the West was kind of in America. You know, on his wall, my dad, when I was growing up, had a picture of William Faulkner. He really idolized America. And I think for him, that was a way of differentiating himself from Vasily and putting distance, a kind of emotional and moral distance between Vasily and himself. You know, and my mother, I think, was kind of living. My mother was the child of Holocaust survivors who had lost most of her family in the Holocaust. You know, I think the fact that they were what was known at that time as a mixed marriage, you know, a Jew and a Gentile, was also put a lot of pressure on her. Her parents didn't approve of my father. You know, and they were also really young. They married when my mother was 20 years old because my father had, you know, knocked her up essentially with me. So they were essentially forced to get married because they were raising a kid together. So it was in some ways a really interesting and troubled marriage. And what I think what I learned while writing this book is that, you know, I think the main insight I had into this country and my family is that a lot of the things that I thought were determined by personality, how two people got along, were in fact things that were determined by history. That history, in fact, was a much stronger influence on all of us than I had ever suspected. But when the last time I spoke to my grandfather, you know, in person, he, you know, kind of took hold of my head and whispered in my ear. He said, I was scared every single day. You know, he went to work, you know, for years thinking that he would probably die, that he would probably not survive, you know. And one of the things that I explore in this book is the notion of, well, how does that affect not just you, but your family? How does that affect your children? How does that affect your grandchildren? What does it mean to live through these things, right? The 20th century was in some ways the most terrible century in human history in terms of, you know, war and destruction and, you know, killing. But at the same time, I think the Soviet Union and Russia had a particularly rough 20th century. I mean, rough is not the word, is it? a particularly bleak and tragic 20th century. And And I was always interested by what it meant to be descended from that, how it colored my mother's and my father's lives, and ultimately how it colored my life. Because I think my father always lived in the shadow of his father. And, you know, and I think in some ways it absolutely determined a lot of the choices he made in his own life. You know, just as my mother was, I think, shaped by the experience of knowing that 80, maybe probably 90% of her extended family had died in the Holocaust. And that, you know, she was born 4 years after the World War II. And, you know, that knowledge shapes one in ways that I think are really profound. So that was one of the themes that I think run through this book is, what does that mean? How does that play out in the lives of ordinary people?
Yeah, and that's something that I would love your take on, because you say that nations possess formative traumas that penetrate into the most private recesses of their citizens' lives. And I'm not even sure I know how to phrase the question properly. So with that, I don't know if you have to give a definitive answer. You can answer it as best you can based on your personal experiences. But this question about being affected by what a nation has done, and some would even argue there's a responsibility to redress that harm. If we take the example of the United States, I've done a lot of episodes where I've looked at issues in the past of slavery, the Civil War. How do people assess their own history? If you're from the South, you may want to try to celebrate what you perceive to be the positive aspects of Southern culture while being able to separate things like institutional slavery. Some would argue those are completely inseparable. Others would say, well, I can't simply curse all of my forefathers, because if you go back far enough in time, all of us have unsavory people in our past, and we simply didn't live in those times, and we can't hold everyone in the past up to today's standards, or everyone is guilty of something in the past. And there's different, and some would say if you take things to a reductio ad absurdum, then everyone has a blood guilt based on people in the past. That's how in the Middle Ages, people would say Jews have a blood guilt because they killed Christ, so we can discriminate them. And a slaveholder would say, well, due to the curse of Ham, all people from Africa are inherently born into weakness. That's the absolute absurd case of it. But then the more level-headed thing would be, we should deal with honest reckonings of our nation's past. Of, there were Japanese internment camps for World War II. There was slavery in the past, so we need to deal with that in some way. And you're looking at this in the case of Russia, that if we don't deal with this in some way, it still affects us and gives us trauma that won't simply go away if we say, well, there were heroes in Russia's past, and let's simply not talk about the bad things, and we can have all the benefits without the negative. So very complicated. I don't even know how to phrase the question, but what's your take on it?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I'm going to just set aside the notion of blame for a minute, because I think it's a, I don't know if it's a really useful way to look at this, because, you know, who's really being blamed and for what, right? I mean, we're talking about events where the perpetrators are long dead, right? So I don't know if sort of the notion of chest beating, you know, saying I have a blood guilt or my ancestors did this evil thing. I don't know if that's an interesting way for me to think about it. But I think what is interesting is this idea of reckoning that you brought up, which is, you know, the idea that I don't think a society can begin to heal until there's been a real reckoning, by which I mean not an accusation from outside, but a society that really is coming to terms with what has happened in its society. And I think you can see that, you know, when we talk about the Holocaust, you can certainly see how Germany has dealt with it, which I think is fascinating. I mean, Germany has, I think, taken a wholesale kind of approach of confrontation. Not, I don't mean every person in Germany, but I mean, I think German society as a whole has been incredibly proactive in trying to really explore sort of what happened during the 1940s of the way, you know, and the great crimes committed by the Third Reich and by many, you know, sectors of German society during that time. But, you know, Germany is not everyone is like Germany, you know. One of the things I talk about in my book is Lithuania, which is where my mother grew up and where I spent a lot of my summers as a kid. You know, that is a nation that had, you know, it's a really interesting country because it was the last country in Europe to adopt Christianity. And for many years was a real haven for Jews. You know, it was a place where, you know, Jews were welcomed initially with essentially an offer of equal rights to Christians. I mean, it was kind of unprecedented in medieval Europe to have a country say, please come live here and we will give you full protection under the law. Because it was a country that came very late to Christianity. And a lot of the historical prejudices that kind of rose up in the church were not present there. Of course, with time that evaporated. And, you know, but remarkably, people in Lithuania lived, Jews and Lithuanians lived together in relative peace for something like 500 years. There were almost no acts of murder or, you know. And then this series of events play out, right? So the Soviet Union invades Lithuania, I think 1939, right? Or excuse me, 1940. Because, you know, the German army is moving east, the Soviet army is moving west. They invade Lithuania. Make it into the Lithuanian Soviet Socialist Republic, and occupy it, you know. And then at the end of that period, I think if I'm remembering correctly, this is June 1941, KGB agents round up tens of thousands of people, put them on board trains, and send them to labor camps. 7,000 of this group, I think of about, I don't have the figure in front of me, but I think it was close to 50,000 people. 7,000 of them are Jews. And then, literally a week later, the German army invades. And, because, the Soviets, I think, saw Jews as being more friendly to them than Lithuanians, because, you know, Russia and Lithuanians have Lithuania has a history of being invaded and occupied by Russia. And also the Jews are terrified of Hitler, right? Because Hitler has already occupied Poland. So they are relieved in a way to see the Soviets arrive because they see the Soviets as protecting them from Hitler, right? But because of this incredibly tragic sequence of events, when the Germans come, whom a lot of Lithuanians see as liberating them from the Soviet occupation. They're, you know, and some of them see Jews as being collaborating with the Soviets, which is not true, but it was perceived that way by some. There's this huge whole-scale reaction where groups of Lithuanians go into the Jewish neighborhoods and start to slaughter Jews. Of course, they're being egged on in this by the newly arrived SS, right? So this remarkably deadly genocide unfolds, really most of it in the space of the first 3 months, you know, in the summer and fall of 1941. And most of the killing was carried out, we know from German documents, by ordinary Lithuanians who were parts of militias that were in some ways commanded by the SS, but nonetheless, they are, you know, they are instrumental in doing it. And the problem is that the country has really never, in my view, had a sort of social reckoning with that history. It was covered up during the Soviet period. Then there was the period of independence. And I think the Lithuanian government was often very much involved in fomenting a kind of nationalism by, you know, as we're seeing in a lot of sort of, I would say, illiberal democracies where governments rely on demonizing outsiders and fomenting ethnic hatreds and homophobia and xenophobia as a way for the government in power to maintain that power, right? Because, as you know, Adolf Eichmann said during, you know, when he was being interviewed during the Nuremberg trials, all you have to do if you want to keep power is to tell people that there's an enemy, and that they have to and that enemy is threatening them, and that what they have to do is turn on that enemy. And then we tell everyone who's opposed to us that they're unpatriotic, right? That's the blueprint of despotism, of, you know, of autocracy everywhere, right? So, and I think, you know, in a place like Lithuania, you have, you know, you have a society that hasn't reckoned with its history, where there's a lot of denial, where a lot of people still say that, you know, the Jews brought it upon themselves by being collaborators with the Soviets, which is simply not true. It's just not supported by any historical facts. There's a lot of denial. And this is not just Lithuania. This is true in places like Hungary, certainly in places like Ukraine and Russia and Belarus. You know, I think a lot of that denial is held in place by lies, by you know, the tendency to distort history, to selectively deny history. And I think it's incredibly unhealthy for the society, because it tends to bring with it other forms of hatred, other forms of bigotry, you know, homophobia, xenophobia, misogyny, you know, the rest of it. And unfortunately, I think for a lot of liberal governments, like we have in Hungary, especially, it's a way for the government to remain in power, to essentially, you know, and we're seeing, of course, some of this happen with, you know, dictators like Bolsonaro in Brazil. I don't want to open a, you know, kettle of fish, but certainly you could say that the same thing happened as Donald Trump was running for president. Some of that rhetoric, you know, of trying to find scapegoats and enemies. So I think generally, it, you know, it's not so much a matter of blame as it is a matter of transparency. If a society refuses to come to terms with what it has done and it has seen, I think you are dealing with a society that is essentially sick, a society that refuses to kind of see itself clearly, that continues to perpetuate these kind of demonizing narratives. And I think what that leads to is, you know, basically unhappiness, poverty, hatred, you know, division, civic division. You know, I don't think I'm saying anything terribly original here. But I think, to answer your question, I think these reckonings, these kinds of, you know, letting the light in and trying to see history as it really is and not as the government wishes it were, which, you know, is a tendency you see in a lot of the world, especially, you know, I think places like Eastern Europe. I think it's good for the society. And I think, you know, we have seen what it has done in Germany. You know, Germany has become, you know, a much more kind of deliberately multi-ethnic, multinational state that is, in some ways, remains the bulwark of our global democracy, right? And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that they did so much work in trying to process and unearth the kind of the evils of the Third Reich and the Holocaust. But you know, this is a conversation that could go on indefinitely, and I don't want to sort of wade into the waters of social analysis too much.
Well, this is very helpful, because trying to answer these questions, you could have a logical syllogism with political theory, or have personal experiences and those stories that could frame those then, and then begin from that as the basis and then work outward and try to answer it, which your book has done. So really appreciate this, Alex. And for those who want to dig in a lot deeper, because there's a lot to unpack here, the book is Young Heroes of the Soviet Union. So Alex, really appreciate this. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Scott. Thank you for having me.
Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.